Today is Monday, February 28th, 2011. I'm Lauren Connerton.
And I'm Preston Clymer, and this is News 101.
Good evening. It's currently...
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening. It's 5:09 and time for a full hour of independent news.
Today we will be discussing the upcoming Engineering Wellness Expo with health reporter Sharon Hundahl, and we will be bringing you part two of our Vancouver Homelessness Special.
All this plus a headline and your weekly weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent, local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, February the 28th, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, the United States calls on Libya's Colonel Gaddafi to step down.
It is time for Gaddafi to go.
After a record protest in Wisconsin over the weekend, rallies continue today against
Unknown
Governor
Abrams.
Walker's
Headlines
anti-union
for
bill.
Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today in a case that centers on the definition of cocaine-based drugs. The outcome could affect sentences for drug offenses involving coca leaves and paste. Last summer, Congress passed the Fairness in Sentencing Act, which lessened dramatic imbalances between mandatory penalties for crack offenses and those meted out for powder cocaine crimes. The U.S. House is expected to vote tomorrow on a tentative temporary budget agreement that could avert a government shutdown for two more weeks. The short-term continuing resolution would cut more than $1 billion in spending cuts already endorsed by President Obama and almost $3 billion in earmarks. The Senate is set to act on the stopgap measure on Wednesday. A family that has come to symbolize the collateral damage of Mexico's drug war says they will protest in Ciudad Juarez indefinitely. Shannon Young has more.
The Reyes Salazar family set up camp outside the special prosecutor's office in Ciudad Juarez 3 weeks ago to demand authorities find three abducted relatives. They launched a hunger strike, then sent some family members to Mexico City, where their case became a leading national news story. On Friday, the bodies of the three missing family members were found dumped on a road in the Juarez Valley agricultural region. Funeral services were held at the family's protest camp in Ciudad Juarez. They then traveled to their depopulated hometown for the burial. The family home was burned down earlier this month. For now, they'll continue to live in their protest camp as they demand the resignation of the special prosecutor. Sara Salazar, who has lost two daughters, two sons, a daughter-in-law, and a grandson to violence since late 2008, says the family may leave Mexico to avoid future murders. Shannon Young, FSRN.
An Afghan government probe of a NATO attack last week in Kunar province found that the international force did fire on civilians. Investigators delivered a report to the Afghan National Security Council yesterday saying that 40 children, 10 women, and 15 men were killed. The UN and the Afghanistan Human Rights Commission are still investigating. Tens of thousands gathered in Cairo's Tahrir Square Friday to mark 1 month since the revolution began. In the evening, a few hundred protesters remained and were beaten by military police. Aya Batraoui has more from Cairo.
Friday night, peaceful protesters in Tahrir Square were attacked by mass military police, who used batons and tasers against them, chasing them down side streets and forcing them to leave the square. Shortly after the incident, the Supreme Council of the Egyptian Armed Forces issued an apology, saying the clashes were due to unintended friction between the military police and Sons of the Revolution. The military, now in control of the country, vowed it would take all precautions to avoid this from happening again. The military appointed 10 new ministers last week, but the move failed to appease protesters who carried on and spent Saturday night in the square. They are calling for the resignation of Prime Minister Ahmed Shafiq and all remaining ministers who were appointed by former President Hosni Mubarak prior to his ouster. Meanwhile, on Monday, Egypt's Attorney General ordered a travel ban on Mubarak and his family, but has not yet ordered their assets to be frozen domestically or internationally. Aya Batraoui, FSRN, Cairo, Egypt.
Pro-democracy protests continue around the world today. In Oman, demonstrations have spread to the capital after as many as six people died yesterday. In Tunisia, another high-level government minister resigned today. Yesterday, Tunisian Prime Minister Mohamed Ghannouchi stepped down. Protests there turned violent again over the weekend. At least four people were killed Saturday, and a BBC reporter witnessed what he called merciless beatings yesterday. Only one member of the now-deposed President Ben Ali cabinet remains. In Yemen, embattled President Ali Abdullah Saleh is expected to declare a unity government in response to uprisings there. Opposition members say they will continue to call for a full regime change. And in West Africa, thousands sought shelter in Côte d'Ivoire over the weekend, where emergency food rations are in short supply. State TV was off the air in Abidjan after its transmitter was set on fire. And the UN says Belarus is delivering three attack helicopters to forces loyal to incumbent holdover Laurent Gbagbo. Belarus denies the report. For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at fsrn.org. I'm Lauren Connerton.
And I'm Hatch Clymer. On Saturday night, Christy Clark was elected as the leader of the BC Liberal Party and became the 35th Premier of British Columbia. Clark, who was a former cabinet minister, left government in 2004 to spend more time with her son and continued to find success in her career as a radio host and newspaper columnist. She gained popularity throughout the race for her discussion of a government for the people, fresh perspective, detailed education platform, and willingness to have open dialogue about the controversial HST. As well, she promises to balance the budget, a task that seems daunting. Clark's leadership competitors George Abbott, Mike DeJong, and Kevin Falcon have all rallied around her following the election, stressing party unity. DeJong, in particular, who may have lost much support due to his place in Gordon Campbell's unpopular government, said, quote, "I'm entirely confident that the party will rally around Christy Clark," end quote.
The UBC Bioenergy Research and Demonstration Project, or the BRDP, received an additional $11.2 million in government and provincial funding today. The $27 million project, which is a partnership with Vancouver-based NextEra Systems Corp. and General Electric, will be the first biomass-fueled heat and power generation system of its kind in the world when it opens in 2012. It is predicted that the BRDP will generate enough clean electricity to power 1,500 homes and reduce UBC's natural gas consumption by up to 12%. That amounts to the elimination of 4,500 tons of greenhouse gas emissions per year from the UBC Vancouver campus, the equivalent of taking 1,100 cars off the road. Quote, "Moving forward aggressively with investments in clean energy technologies will help us balance our need for energy with our need to protect the environment," end quote, said the Honourable Lynn Leach, Minister of State for Western Economic Diversification. $10.2 million of the funding came from the federal support and the remaining $1 million from the BC Ministry of State for Climate Action. The facility will also provide opportunities for researchers to conduct research and development of bioenergy systems, in addition to producing clean energy for campus.
Yay, going green, and more. The recent heavy snow and poor weather conditions have led to icy roads and dangerous driving conditions in Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. There have been numerous crashes as a result, the most recent involving a young woman in her mid-20s. At about 10 a.m. this morning, February 28th, she lost control of her car on a bridge. This is terrible. I'm sorry. On Highway 99 in Surrey and plunged into the Serpentine River below. RCMP drivers pulled the woman from the river, and she is currently in very grave condition. There were at least three other serious crashes Monday morning and a number of other recent bridge accidents. Bad weather and poor road conditions are thought to be a factor in all. Transit has also been affected by the weather, bad weather, and crashes causing delays in bus schedules. We're going to take a quick break now, but stay with us. You're listening to CITR News 101.
Government and Big Pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Now, it is time for our health segment with Sharon Hundile.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be back this week. So this week, we spoke to organizers of the next wellness fair that is available to students for free on campus. There has been a huge effort by the UBC Wellness Center and faculties to offer their students health info and resources to help them study better ultimately. Let's hear what the organizers had to say about the upcoming Engineering Wellness Expo. I'm here with Laz, a fifth-year engineering student and fellow wellness peer educator from the UBC Wellness Center. We're also here with the coordinator of the Wellness Center, Kelly White. So today we're talking about the second annual Engineering Wellness Expo taking place on March 8th and 9th next week. So Laz, can you tell us a little bit about this initiative? Why has it been an interest for engineers to talk about health recently?
Well, I think it's always been an interest for engineers to talk about health. It's definitely a primary focus as you transition to university. You're dealing with a much bigger course load than you were in high school, and engineering is a very particularly challenging program. And so students have trouble with balancing their overall health with their academic requirements, and in some cases with their social life. And so this is something that we've kind of brought to engineering, because engineering students don't usually come out to the classical events like Thrive Week or Things in the Sub. And so we decided that by bringing the fair to engineering, we could then help some of these students and provide important resources that they might not know about otherwise.
Sounds like a great effort. So what would you say are the top health issues for engineering students?
Well, so actually, that was one of the questions we had when we were planning this out. And so we created an online survey, which then was addressed particularly at engineers, looking at what are their core concerns with regard to health issues. Some of the things we found were nutrition was a major topic. Stress management was a very major topic, time management, and sexual health as well were in the top kind of areas. And drugs and alcohol was an important consideration as well. So overall, it was a little bit of everything. The primary focus was nutrition and kind of stress management.
Okay, great. So Kelly, knowing of all the issues that are affecting engineering students, what role does the Wellness Center have in planning this wellness fair?
Sure. Well, the Wellness Center is a resource for students to come and visit and ask a health question to their peers. And we're operating out of the sub, so we're on the bottom floor across from Sprouts. And not all the students on campus know about our service and how to reach us, so sometimes we have thought in the past year that it'd be great to take our initiatives and our work outside of the sub and to the students directly where they are. So students who are studying off in a building far away and don't have a chance to head over this direction, we want to make sure they still have the same access to services and resources and health information. So this past term, we actually had a wellness event in three faculties. We had it in arts in January, a science wellness fair in February, and now this engineering one's coming up next week. Next year, we'd like to even go bigger and have a wellness event in each of the faculties on campus if we can get the support and collaboration from students in those other faculties.
Wow, sounds like a huge effort, and I'm glad that it's spreading across campus. So let's talk more about the event details. When and where is this taking place?
So it's taking place next week on Tuesday and Wednesday, March 8th and 9th. In the Kaiser Atrium. It's going to be 11 to 2. It's going to be a fair style, and it's going to be for all engineering students or any students passing by. We're going to have tons of resources, everyone from a chiropractor to massage therapy, mm-hmm. to the wellness peers and various aspects of the Wellness Center. And the key thing here is we want to get students out, and so we're actually offering a grand prize of a draw. Wow. Valued at least $500, including free sessions with weight training and chiropractor as well, and then also some gift certificates and an overall wellness kind of gift prize.
Wow, it sounds like a makeover almost for wellness, right? And now, could you talk a little bit about last year and how this year will be different or even better at the fair? It seems like you have a lot going on with these prizes and stuff like that, but what can we expect?
So last year's Engineering Wellness Fair was the first time we'd ever held it outside of the sub. It was the first time we went to any faculty, and we brought specifically targeted resources to an engineering faculty. We kind of took a sampling of everything and tried to really get the word out and provide resources. This year we've gone in depth into more resources and really kind of fine-tuning some of the activities we brought last year in order to improve the quality of the resources and to make sure that engineers relate even better to some of these issues that we're bringing up and some of the things that we're talking about.
Okay, so it seems like a lot of research has gone into this. Great, and feedback from students, I guess. Did you want to add anything,
yes,
Kelly?
I just wanted to say that last year's fair was a full day, but this year we've broken it up over 2 days in a shorter period of time. Some of the feedback from last year was that engineering students weren't aware that it was happening. They found out too late and weren't able to attend. So we're hoping that this year, if you're there on the first day on March 8th on Tuesday, that maybe you'll tell your friends and come back the next day, because we want to make sure as many people as possible are able to attend.
Great. Well, thank you for sitting down with us and even having this interview. So this is one great way that we hope people can get the word out. Now, where can we get more information about the fair if a student's considering coming but wants a little bit more info?
So we've got tons of information up both through Facebook and the UBC Engineering website, or UBC EUS website. You can look for us. Also, we've got posters up everywhere. But just come by Kaiser Atrium next week, Tuesday and Wednesday. There'll be tons of people there you can talk about for resources and find out lots of information about great health topics.
Okay, great. And I suspect the Wellness Center is also a good place to stop by.
Absolutely it is.
Okay.
I don't suspect, you know.
Okay, great. Thanks again for your interview and good luck with the fair.
So I'd like to thank Laz and Kelly once again for that great interview. And I'm also a member of the planning committee, as I'm the project assistant over at the Wellness Center. So what wasn't mentioned was the cheap and healthy food for sale and given free as samples at the fair. So that's always a really popular thing among students, and there'll be lots of activities about how to prepare cheap and healthy meals. So another thing is a fitness membership that will be part of the grand prize is provided by the UBC Bird Coop, and they have great resources as well, and it's definitely worth it to come check that out for the grand prize. So hope you guys can come out. Thanks.
Thanks for that, Sharon. Now it's time for your weekday weather forecast, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Tonight, there'll be showers with low of 1. Tomorrow, 40% showers, low of 2, high of 6. Wednesday, rain, low 4, high of 7. Thursday, showers, low of 3, high of 7. Friday, rain, low of 3, high of 7. Saturday, rain, low of 3, high of 8. Sunday, showers, low of 2, high of 7. Thanks to the Storm Club for that. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to CITR News 101.
Shapeless fears. Who can live in the modern world without catching his share of them? I hope I've landed on my feet this time.
Need a place to rent? Have a place for rent? AMS Rents Line can help. AMS Rents Line is an easy-to-operate, touch-tone, and web-based system that connects thousands of landlords with UBC students looking for off-campus housing. UBC students can search the ads for free or place a 2-week posting for $5. To view current listings, visit www.amsrentsline.com.
I was a prisoner.
I was a prisoner.
Cocaine addiction.
Cocaine took my drink. It made me lie.
Cocaine took my will, my soul.
And all I wanted was more cocaine. Cocaine Anonymous gave me freedom and saved my life. If you got a problem with cocaine, pick up the phone. We're here to help.
1-866-662-8300.
Welcome back. I'm Hatch Clymer, and you are hearing us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. The current time is 5:29.
Now it's time for our part two of our special segment on homelessness in Vancouver. For that, we go to Claire Eagle.
The Olympics brought with them a flurry of international tourists, press, and excitement. However, amidst all of this, the problems of affordable housing in Vancouver and the startling poverty that is found on the city's downtown east side were issues addressed far less than local advocates had hoped. And so, an idea was born. The Pivot Legal Society started the Red Tent Campaign, attaching a memorable icon to the issue that caused a stir across Canada. Today, I spoke with Doug King, a lawyer and housing campaign leader at the Pivot Legal Society, about the Red Tent campaign, changes that the Downtown East Side has seen since the Olympics last February, and the ongoing problem of affordable housing in Vancouver. So, Doug, what can you tell me about that campaign, especially in 2010 with the Olympics?
Yeah, I guess the Olympics was kind of the birthplace of the Red Tent campaign, and it was really structured to be a campaign to bring attention to the housing and homelessness issues in Vancouver in the lead-up to the Olympic Games, and the fact that we were making a choice to spend our money on the Olympics and not necessarily on the housing problems that we have. So it all started basically with just an order for tents that was made by Pivot. We had some volunteers that helped out with the design of the tents. We decided we wanted to have a color associated with them, like red, that would draw attention to the issue rather than kind of hide it. And it was actually based on a campaign that had similarly taken place in France during the last presidential election to raise the issues of homelessness in Paris. And we kind of drew from the experience that they'd had and wanted to make it kind of unique to Vancouver. So we put some sayings on the side of the tents that relate to the Canadian issues. And really quickly, people kind of gravitated towards the tents as a symbol for the housing and homelessness issues.
And who did you see gravitating? I mean, was it just people on the streets, people especially in the Downtown East Side and in that community, or do you feel that people across Vancouver really latched onto it as well?
Well, it was interesting because we definitely expected, a certain type of person to be really connected to the campaign, to be really interested in it, the kind of person that's been in touch with housing issues in Vancouver, and it's not really a big surprise to them that we have housing issues. What we were surprised to see is how kind of broadly it took off, how we had interest from other parts of society that we don't usually have a connection with. You know, the average person in Vancouver seemed to really connect with the idea of using something like a tent to kind of proactively raise the issue and not necessarily just kind of negatively complaining about the issue. And the other big surprise was how much of a reception we got just from the homeless community in Vancouver and how much of a demand we had to use the tent, not as a symbol for homelessness, but as a remedy for homeless and to actually use it to sleep in.
Wow, that sounds great. Did it end up going in other places other than Vancouver then?
It did. The last year, so after the Olympics kind of died down, I guess if you could say that one thing that we benefited from the Olympics was because it was an international event and a national event, really, it brought some attention to other issues that maybe wouldn't normally have been focused on. And one of those was the housing issues in Vancouver. So we got contacted by a lot of different groups all across the country who were interested in bringing the red tents to where they were and kind of signing on to the campaign. So we consciously wanted to promote it as turn it into a national campaign. And since that time, we've made connections and we've sent tents to pretty much every province across the country.
So I guess what's next? Do you think, have the red tents, besides creating awareness, do you think that change has come about? And do you foresee a solution to affordable housing, especially in Vancouver? Or do you think this problem is going to continue to develop?
It's, in Vancouver specifically, I think it's just going to be an issue for so long. Really, the solution is going to span out over decades, but there are some indications that things are going in the right direction. You know, that being said, there's also a very intense fight that's going on the Downtown East Side regarding gentrification and whether or not private market development should be allowed to continue in the way that it has, building more towers, building more condos. That's really one of the areas where there's a fight. And even though there's been a greater commitment from the municipal government and from the provincial government to commit and to build social housing, at the same time, it's kind of happening in conjunction with an increase or an ongoing efforts to, promote really high-level, high-income development. And a lot of the times, it doesn't seem like that's really compatible.
I know that they've been doing some of the mixed housing, where they have part of it is, more low-income or supported income, and then part of it seems to be more high-end. How are these projects? Do you think they're successful? Are they useful? Or
I would say, without making a terrible pun, it's kind of mixed reviews. In some ways, it's good. On the one hand, everyone that I've talked to and that I know personally who's been housed in the Woodwards building, which is the social housing part of Woodwards, mm-hmm. is really, really happy with it. It's one of the nicest buildings that's been made in Vancouver for social housing, and they really love the environment. It's a huge step up from where they were living before. And it's kind of difficult because you have to kind of balance that positive that obviously came with it, with the reality that the market part of Woodward's, the high-end condos that came with it, had a really tremendous effect on the neighborhood, and it really changed that whole block that they're on. A lot of the change that we've seen is not just that the condos have come in, but the businesses in the downtown east side that used to cater towards, you know, the more traditional residents, the residents who have been here for a long time, are really starting to cater towards the people moving into the neighborhood and the high end and the wealthy.
Keeping that in mind, how do you see development changing for the downtown east side? What are plans that are in the works for the future besides the growth of more low-income housing areas?
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing is I think the only real difference between the downtown east side and the rest of Vancouver is perhaps the need for more social housing. The issues that surround the downtown east side with market housing, I think, are the same issues that the rest of the city has. All of the other areas, parts of the city, they don't really need condos as much as the downtown east side does, and it's kind of symptomatic of our housing market in general in Vancouver. And people are really starting to come out and say we need to take an examination of where we're going with our development, because we've put ourselves in a very vulnerable position. There's more and more talk about a housing bubble, and it just doesn't seem logical to keep building kind of high-end wealthy condos for buyers all over the city when that's not what the demand is inside the city. The only people that it seems like who are interested in buying those condos, who are able to buy those condos, are people from outside of Vancouver. You know, it's the working class, it's kind of the middle class, even the professional class, that's having a hard time finding housing in Vancouver. And that's an issue in the downtown east side as much as it is everywhere else. So whereas the downtown east side has an ongoing need that I think the governments are really starting to address for more social housing, I think really what needs to be done at the same time is taking a look at the way that we build all over Vancouver and kind of think about how to take care of everybody in our society for the future.
All right, well, it was great chatting with you today, Doug. Best of luck with your ongoing campaigns.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. So that was Doug King from the Pivot Legal Society here in Vancouver, which is a group that aims to use law to address the root causes of poverty and social exclusion. So he spoke with me today about the society's Red Tent campaign, as well as changes in the downtown east side and the ongoing issue of affordable housing in Vancouver. For CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, I'm Claire Eagle.
Thanks, Claire. Due to the important issues in the Middle East and United States, we are now going to go to Free Speech Radio News for more insight into this.
In support of what we believe is right. We believe this is an assault on the entire citizenry of the state of Wisconsin.
And we go to Argentina, where trials begin against dictatorship-era leaders involved in kidnapping babies from activists they detained and disappeared. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today in a case that centers on the definition of cocaine-based drugs. The outcome could affect sentences for drug offenses involving coca leaves and paste. Last summer, Congress passed the Fairness in Sentencing Act, which lessened dramatic imbalances between mandatory penalties.
All precautions to avoid this from happening again. The military appointed 10 new ministers last week, but the move failed to appease protesters who carried on and spent Saturday night in the square.
An arms embargo and recommended the International Criminal Court investigate human rights abuses. And the U.S. and European Union are moving forward with implementing that resolution. They are freezing the Libyan government's assets. WikiLeaks cables reveal U.S. banks are home to $500 million worth of Libyan assets. Secretary Clinton said the U.N. resolution is a first step.
As we move forward on these fronts, we will continue to explore all possible options for action. As we have said, nothing is off the table so long as the Libyan government continues to threaten and kill Libyans.
The international community is considering additional action, including military engagement. The U.S. is working with the British government on imposing a military no-fly zone. Prime Minister David Cameron spoke to the House of Commons Monday.
And we do not in any way rule out the use of military assets. We must not tolerate this regime using military force against its own people. And in that context, I've asked the Ministry of Defence and the Chief of Defence Staff to work with our allies on plans for a military no-fly zone.
A no-fly zone would engage the international military by enabling aggressive response to any Libyan military aircraft. A Pentagon spokesperson told reporters that the U.S. is moving an aircraft and naval forces into the region to prepare for possible military intervention. The U.S. military was not mounted during uprisings in Egypt, Bahrain, nor Tunisia. Adil E. Shamu is a senior analyst for foreign policy and focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. He says the U.S. and the international community are intentionally selective on military intervention. He says in Libya's deadly protests, the military option is rather swift.
They have oil and we want it and we want to keep track of it.
Libya's wealth is in oil. It's Europe's largest supplier. According to business media reports, Libya's oil production has been reduced by 50% since uprisings began. Shamu also says that the U.S. will be better received if the U.S. leaves its military out of it.
There is such a risk, and especially nowadays, that the Arab world is in revolt, and they want to earn their freedom and democracy. They don't want foreign troops, especially from the U.S. and NATO, to help them do that, because we'll remind them of all the past ills of foreign policy of the West towards the Arabs, of supporting corrupt regimes for decades.
Despite all of this, Gaddafi remains resilient. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
In an interview with the BBC, Libyan leader Colonel Gaddafi repeated the assertion that he would not step down from power. He still maintains control of most of the capital, but some reports say the coastal city of Misurata is now in the hands of the opposition, and a standoff continues in another northwestern city, Zawiya, between Gaddafi loyalists and opposition forces. Libya's second largest city, Benghazi, has now been free of Gaddafi's control for more than a week. The Real News Network's Jihan Hafiz files this report.
Across the border from Egypt, there is a new sovereign country ruled by revolutionaries. After 42 years under the rule of President Colonel Muammar al-Gaddafi, the Libyan people are in full revolt and are now firmly in control of the eastern part of the country. In the liberated city of Benghazi, the stronghold of the opposition, the people have formed a deep sense of community. This is a revolution without leaders and tens of thousands of volunteers. People collect donated food, some coming in from neighboring Egypt and Tunisia, and safeguard it in the warehouse before distributing it for free to the population. The shops and restaurants surrounding the city now serve as communal kitchens for the revolution.
I cook every day, sometimes rice, sometimes macaroni, sometimes kiksu and beans. It tastes good and everyone is well fed. Thank God.
Foreign journalists were seldom seen here. Now they are welcomed with open arms and report freely. The first independent newspaper in liberated Benghazi, named after the February 17th uprising that led to the government's ouster from the city.
The newspapers and magazines could not discuss the regime, and freedom of the press was non-existent. He'd cut them completely. Journalists that attempted to be freed disappeared. Not just them, but their immediate and extended family would vanish.
But liberating eastern Libya of the Gaddafi regime came at a heavy price. It's estimated over 1,000 civilians were killed when the regime responded to the peaceful protests with extreme violence. Some of the images we've obtained are too gruesome to broadcast. The hospitals are still packed with patients with gunshot wounds.
After the violent battle for the eastern city of Benghazi, there's no turning back for the people here. You're hearing them screaming, the people of Zawiya will join us. They're counting on the other cities in the west to join them in a fight against a leader who has ruled this country for 42 years.
Libya's second largest city has become the unofficial capital of this uprising, and thousands of protesters continue streaming in from the surrounding region. Gaddafi has called the pro-democracy demonstrators extremists and members of al-Qaeda, but people here refute those claims as absurd.
We don't have radical people. Our Muslims are moderate. I am sure we will inspire a lot of Arab nations, I am sure, and also Muslim nations. Libya will inspire the world. No. Libya will inspire the world. Libya, Libya.
These sisters lost their father when he drove his car into Gaddafi's military barracks. The crash was the turning point in the battle for Benghazi as thousands stormed the building, liberating the city. They call them martyrs, and the memory of how and why they died fuels this revolution. The celebration of Eastern Libya's freedom continued late into Friday night as people were elated to hear of Libyans revolting in other parts of the country. Many here believe it's a matter of days before the force of people power makes history once again in the latest and bloodiest Arab uprising to rock the region since the beginning of the year. Jahan Hafiz for The Real News in Benghazi, Libya.
More than 100,000 people rallied outside the Wisconsin state capitol on Sunday in the largest demonstration against the governor's anti-union bill in 2 weeks. Protests continue in and around the capitol today, despite restricted access to the building this morning. The governor is set to unveil a new two-year state budget on Tuesday. Molly Stentz and Joanne Powers have the story from Madison, Wisconsin.
Protesters swarmed the Capitol steps, lawn, sidewalks, and every surrounding street. Celebrities Bradley Whitford of the West Wing TV show, as well as Jeff Skiles, the Miracle on the Hudson co-pilot, gave rousing speeches. The head of the largest teachers union in the state addressed the crowd with a spoof on the infamous prank call that Governor Walker took with someone he believed was oil magnate David Koch.
This is Mary Bell. I'm the president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council. I know you might not know who I am. I have been walking kind of around the Capitol for a couple of weeks. You might have seen me with one of those signs that says, please stop the attacks on working families. I know, you're a busy guy. You got a lot of things to do. You probably don't have time for a junior high teacher from Wisconsin Rapids. It's tough, but, you know, Governor Walker, Wisconsin Rapids is in Wisconsin.
However, throughout the weekend, law enforcement limited access to the Capitol, keeping numbers in the building far below that of earlier demonstrations. Protesters in the partially filled Capitol called for them to be allowed in. Police had announced that the Capitol would close at 4 p.m. Sunday, and they'd remove hundreds of protesters who had been occupying the building constantly for the previous 2 weeks. This was not favorably received by demonstrators, many of whom planned civil disobedience in order to stay. Brian Austin, representing the rank and file of the Madison Police Department, was one of several law enforcement officers willing to risk arrest.
We're standing in support of what we believe is right. We believe this is an assault on the entire citizenry of the state of Wisconsin. So we've come here today prepared for whatever might happen. Certainly there's a chance. Anytime you exercise your right to protest and civil disobedience, I can tell you if it does happen, it'll be a very peaceful and cordial event, but there's certainly the possibility we could be arrested.
While some activists and union representatives negotiated with Capitol Police to evacuate the Capitol at 4, several others occupying the Capitol rejected the plan, noting the negotiators weren't representing them. Elizabeth Wrigley Field, a member of the Teaching Assistance Association and the Kill the Whole Bill Coalition, spent the afternoon campaigning for the latter option.
One side of the debate believed that we would not be able to hold the Capitol, and so it was just about crafting a good picture for the media of a few people getting arrested in a flashy way. And others of us felt like we could actually win this. We can hold this building if we have enough people with the sense that that's what we're going to do. And I am very pleased that I feel it's been shown in practice that we do have actually a tremendous amount of power when there's a lot of us with a united purpose.
With hundreds refusing to leave the rotunda, Capitol Police and officers from dozens of other jurisdictions across the state finally ended the standoff shortly before 8 p.m., allowing the protesters to remain overnight. Here's Capitol Police Chief Charles Tubbs.
I want you to know, we have no intentions of arresting peaceful protesters, okay?
While protesters managed to hold the Capitol for the night, by Monday morning, law enforcement was again restricting access to the building to only, quote, official government business, unquote. However, Monday morning, Democratic Assemblywoman Kelda Hellenroys was refused entry to the building because she refused to show her state ID.
I just simply don't believe that there's any public safety or legal justification for eliminating the public's access to this building. And frankly, limiting the media access. I think it's been difficult for media to get in as well. It seems very clear that this governor is willing to do anything to consolidate his power and to trample on the rights of others.
Protesters say they plan to remain at the Capitol as long as they can. Governor Walker is set to unveil the state's new two-year budget on Tuesday. With Joanne Powers, I'm Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison, Wisconsin.
Over the weekend, women's rights activists rallied in major cities across the country, protesting the package of budget cuts passed by the House of Representatives that would defund women's health clinics like Planned Parenthood. In Washington, D.C., the Young Women's Project organized a rally to bring the discussion away from politics and budgets and back to the women who would be affected. Alice Olstein has more.
Gay, straight, black, white, all unite for women's rights. Gay, straight, black, white, all unite for women's rights. Gay, straight, black, white, all unite for women's rights.
A large crowd gathered in D.C.'s busy DuPont Circle in defense of Title X, which funds family planning clinics nationwide. Gray-haired retirees marched alongside teenage girls with nose rings and dreadlocks, waving signs telling politicians to keep their laws off women's bodies and to protect funding for reproductive health services. Young women with low incomes would be the hardest hit by the GOP-backed proposals, which could cut more than $300 million from Title X. D.C. native Becky Levy was one of the first to arrive at the rally. For her, the issue is personal.
I've depended on Planned Parenthood as a primary source for gynecological care my whole life, and it's meant the difference between stability and chaos for me and, like, every one of my friends. It's very important, and it's about so much more than abortion.
According to Planned Parenthood, a full quarter of American women have used their services at some point in their lives, and for more than 3 million women, it's their primary source of health care. The organization provides birth control, cancer screening, and abortions, amongst other health care services. Heather Kangas is an organizer with the International Socialist Organization. She got on the megaphone at the D.C. rally to talk about the ramifications of these cuts.
They're absurd. Cutting funding for breast exams, for birth control, for contraception, for an organization that does more to prevent unwanted pregnancy and abortion than any other organization does. And Planned Parenthood is not just about abortion. It is about women's health. It's about reproductive rights.
Title X already stipulates that no federal dollars can go towards abortions, and Planned Parenthood says no federal money is used for those services. For many young women, Planned Parenthood clinics are one of the only places to get low-cost health care. Christina Ramos is with the Young Women's Project, which advocates for low-income teen girls in D.C.
If Planned Parenthood were to be defunded, it would be an atrocity, and it would cripple America, really. And it would make abortion go up, it would make teen pregnancy go up, poverty would escalate. It's a bad, bad, bad decision.
This rally was just one of hundreds across the country and around the world. From Los Angeles to New York City to Melbourne, Australia, activists called on the U.S. Senate to save Title X from the chopping block. The Senate plans to take up the budget bill early this week. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The trial of Utah environmental activist Tim DeChristopher started today in Salt Lake City's district court. DeChristopher is charged with one count of violating the federal Onshore Oil and Gas Leasing Reform Act and one count of making a false statement. If convicted, he faces a possible 10 years in prison and a total of $750,000 in fines. In December 2008, DeChristopher won bids on oil and gas leases for more than 20,000 acres of land near national parks, but he had no intention of paying for the leases. He said his aim was to disrupt the sale to protest the impact of fossil fuels on climate change. In April 2009, DeChristopher spoke with Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman.
The first time that an IPCC scientist put her hand on my shoulder and said, "I'm sorry, my generation failed yours," you know, that really shook me to the core and made me realize just how late in the game we are with dealing with climate change and how dark and desperate of a future we might be looking at. And I think that by preparing for that completely chaotic and ugly future that we're already on track for helps me to in prison as something that I can deal with, because I've already started preparing myself to deal with those catastrophic effects that we might be looking at.
A judge blocked the sale of the leases on some 100,000 acres in January 2009, and the following Interior Secretary Ken Salazar cancelled them altogether. This morning, several hundred of his supporters marched to the courthouse to express their solidarity with DeChristopher. His trial is expected to last several days. You're listening to FSRN. This week, former members of Argentina's military dictatorship, including Jorge Rafael Videla and Roberto Bignone, will appear in a Buenos Aires court. They face accusations of devising a systematic plan to kidnap children. FSRN's Marcus Federman has more on the case.
When the military junta ruled the country between 1976 and 1983, political and social activists were kidnapped, tortured, killed, and their bodies disappeared. Hundreds of pregnant women were among them. Their babies were born in captivity, taken away from them, and given to families who were friends of the military. More than 15 years ago, the grandmothers of these children filed lawsuits which are now finally going to trial. Coordinator of the grandmother's legal team, Alain Yud, says this trial could have a big symbolic impact because it shows survivors of the dictatorship that fighting for justice is worthwhile.
We'll try to prove that the military leaders were responsible for the kidnapping of babies that took place during the dictatorship. It wasn't a matter of isolated decisions made by each single abductor. This was an institutional decision made by the armed forces.
Human rights NGOs estimate that more than 500 children were born in concentration camps and kidnapped by the military. This week's trial is based on 34 cases that took place in the two largest concentration camps, ESMA and Campo de Mayo. ESMA was a marine institution until 2004, when it was turned into the Memory Museum by former President Néstor Kirchner. On a tour of the museum, historian and guide Débora Traverso takes visitors into a gray and cold room where the concentration camp's maternity ward was located.
Kidnapped and pregnant women had some benefits here in the maternity room. Benefits were given so they give birth to a healthy child. They were brought here in the seventh or eighth month of pregnancy. But until the seventh month of pregnancy, they went through the same system of being kidnapped and tortured, just like the rest of the detainees.
Former dictator Videla is one of the defendants. He was sentenced to life in prison last September, after he took responsibility for dictatorship-era crimes, including a plan to eliminate those who opposed the dictatorship. There are some in Argentina, however, who don't agree with revisiting these crimes. Cecilia Pando is president of the Association of Family and Friends of Political Prisoners, an organization that defends military accused of human rights violations.
We have a position concerning all of these trials. They violate the constitutional rights of every detainee. Crimes committed by the military and the terrorists have already passed the statute of limitations. They are being accused of crimes against humanity, which is a mistake because the legal concept did not exist during that time. You cannot apply the law retroactively.
According to human rights NGOs, 30,000 people were kidnapped, tortured, murdered, and disappeared. Carlos Muñoz was lucky. He defines himself as an ex-disappeared. He suffered 14 months of torture in ESMA, the former concentration camp and present memory museum. He works every day at the museum, making sure no damage is done to the evidence that is still being uncovered and used in dozens of trials.
The idea is to create a huge cultural center where we remember what happened during the dark years of the dictatorship, so it stays in the conscience of every Argentine. This seemed an impossible dream coming true. Those of us who were imprisoned here believed we wouldn't leave this place alive.
Last December, former dictator Videla, was condemned to life in prison for the death of 31 activists during his dictatorship. If found guilty, he might receive his second life sentence at the age of 86. Most likely, his life will end in prison. Marcos Federman, FSRN, Buenos Aires, Argentina.
And that's today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor was Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Scott Pham and Jane Chang. Thanks to KPFA, the Real News Network, Nathan Moore, the FSRN Board and Steering Committee, and many others for relentless work to make sure FSRN stays on the air. For more information on how you can support FSRN, go to our website, fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.
And that's our program for February 28th, 2011. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. Also, if you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. We are currently looking for reporters to join our news team, so please contact us if you are interested. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITR News. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Lauren Connerton.
For sure. And I'm Hatch Clymer. This show was produced by Claire.